Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Delighted to welcome Lawrence Jones here today. Lawrence is a clinical and forensic psychologist, and he's currently head of psychology at Rampton High Secure Hospital, as well as being honorary associate clinical professor at Nottingham University. Teaches regularly on the Sheffield and Leicester clinical psychology doctorate courses, as well as on the forensic doctorate at Nottingham University, and has previously been the chair of the Division of Forensic Psychology. Lawrence has a long and extensive career within forensic services across both the criminal justice and mental health settings, with a significant amount of time spent working within therapeutic communities. Lawrence is trained in multiple models of psychological therapy, including schema-focused therapy, dialectical behaviour therapy, and cognitive analytic therapy, which he's integrated into his knowledge of TC culture and treatment. And I think, Lawrence, you've worked really hard throughout your career to try and find ways to ensure the services that you're responsible for are as accessible as possible to as broad a range of patients as possible. Lawrence has very many publications to his name, but I think what particularly stands out as being of interest to you looking at those publications is an interest in furthering an understanding of those who attract a diagnosis of personality disorder and also offsetting the adverse impacts of chronic trauma and loss of liberty. So with all of that big introduction, really delighted to welcome you here today. Thanks very much for coming on and being willing to engage in a conversation with us. So it seems as if from even very early on in your career, Lawrence, you've been interested in working in places where you've been given consideration to the richness of the environment. Did you stumble into this via good fortune, or was that something that you were consciously aware of and sought out?
Probably a bit of both, actually. I've always been interested in social context, and probably going back to my school days, actually. I remember working with my headmaster at one point when I'd been involved with bullying at school. Being on the receiving end of bullying, I think. And he was incredibly receptive to sort of suggestions about how to deal with that. And one of my suggestions, because I was quite active politically at in my youth, was to introduce elections. And he did that. And this is kind of a long time ago, and probably quite unusual for schools to do that. So introduced, you know, each class had a representative who was elected, and the suggestion was that if people were being bullied, maybe they could speak to their peers. I remember learning a lot from that, though, because it's often the most popular people who were voted in, who were not always, but sometimes in cahoots with the people who were doing the bullying. And so I learned a lot about politics from that. But that's, I guess, about working with the environment. And then prior to training as a psychologist, one of my first jobs was working in a hostel that was run by a guy, Alan Dupuis, who was very, I think, ahead of his time. He was a personal construct psychotherapist. And the hostel was run loosely on therapeutic community principles, not as kind of intense as other therapeutic communities, but we had community meetings every morning and we all took it in turns and cooking. I remember being interviewed and not knowing who were staff and who were residents. I was interviewed by the residents for that post and definitely learnt a lot from that experience. Well, both, I suppose, about the importance of the environment and the power, I suppose, of working in groups. And did some kind of training whilst I was there, also in group analytic therapy. So, yes, the chance bit, I think, was probably getting that job, because I think when I went for that job, there were two jobs that I went for, and I was offered both of them, and it was just almost a toss of a coin whether I went for the the hostel job or not. So there is some, I wouldn't say it was an active process of me seeking out working with environments, but But that's definitely been a feature of what I've been in, what I've been interested in working with for, since quite early on. I suppose also I've had a, an interest in kind of sociological and social perspectives and the importance of context and the broader context in terms of what drives or impacts on problems in people's lives. So yes, thinking about culture as well, like I come from a very complex background. I was born in South Africa. My mother was from Brazil. I lived in Brazil for a while. And then sort of as a kid and then arrived in North Wales, which was a bit of a jolt. So there's also very much for me in my childhood a theme of understanding different cultures, but also working with trying to translate from different, between different worlds. In fact, that's really quite important for me. So it's not just understanding context, but understanding diversity of culture in contexts, and how I guess also how monocultures can be quite harmful. I guess diversity, I think, is quite important for me. Having different perspectives and holding on to that, and I think that's a big part of the way in which environments can impact on people. There are some environments where you can't tolerate difference, and other environments which are much more capable of working with and tolerating different perspectives and ways of seeing and understanding.
That's really interesting to hear that about that cultural change from Brazil to Wales sounds really quite dramatic, but I think it's really interesting to hear that, because I think a lot of the things that you've been associated with are actually really quite disruptive, progressive ways of trying to approach things that can feel quite stuck within forensic services. So the idea of doing things differently, and I think you have to be comfortable with diversity and difference in order to take the risk of doing something that goes outside, you know, the normal run of the mill of what's offered, and to do something that it can feel quite risky to try something new and innovative. But of course, we don't get any change or progress if people aren't prepared to take those risks. So it's really interesting to hear that in your history.
It's an interesting word, disrupt. I suppose it could be disruptive. It's also pushing at growth points, I think, would be my preferred way of describing that.
Me listening to too many American podcasts, Lawrence.
I think there's identifying places where there's room for growth and trying to push at those, I think, is for me been quite important. And I guess if you look at what I was doing on the Max Glatt, quite often what I was trying to do was work with cognitive behavioural ways of thinking and psychodynamic ways of thinking, who were both models which in some ways were at war with each other at that time particularly, and trying to find ways of translating and describing things in each other's languages. I think I probably did more in terms of trying to bring ideas over from psychodynamic thinking into CBT, though I didn't, there's lots of stuff in psychodynamic thinking which I decided I didn't like, but there was huge amounts I thought that were just totally being ignored by people thinking in CBT ways, and so that's about, I guess, translating what I thought was really useful from one language to another, and recognizing and accepting different cultures. And so on the Max Glatt, you know, we had Ronnie Doctor, who's coming in as a psychoanalyst, running groups, and we had in fact, Max Glatt, who had come in with his perspective, which was he's an amazing man. He was German with a Jewish background, and had been involved with had been in concentration camp, and would use his experiences very actively to make sense of power relationships in groups, and had an incredible knack for looking at different sides of arguments. But yeah, he didn't have a kind of a model. So I think there's definitely something about on that pluralism of cultures on that unit.
That's very interesting, Lawrence. The Max Glatt Centre was, of course, at Wilmot Scrubs Prison, wasn't it?
Yes.
An apparently fairly hostile setting, one would think, from the outside of that particular prison. How long were you there?
Well, I was in the prison service for 10 years at Wormwood Scrubs. But I would say, well, for a lot of that, I was working or partly involved with the Max Glatt. It was formerly called the Annex. I guess it's really towards the end of my stay there that I got much more involved. In fact, ended up taking a leadership role there. And that, I guess, would be the last 5 or 6 years of my time there. But I was very sort of motivated to get involved with that because I'd come from a TC, as a hostel that had been run on TC principles. And in terms of hostile, there were times when the organisation was very supportive of it. And I remember when I first got involved, there'd been a period when it had been virtually on its knees and it was just like a landing with which had a bunch of guys who met occasionally. It was that kind of feel to it. So we had to really sort of pull it up and shape it up and get premises, new premises and that sort of thing. And got a lot of support to do that for a while. But then, yes, there was, so I think I'll describe it more as a kind of organisational ambivalence. There was some really strong supportive processes, but there were also some more complex other sort of dynamics around that. So you could describe it as hostile. There were difficult times because I think there was cost improvements or the equipment, what they called cuts, I think they called them then. And so there was this incredible, always a question mark hanging over you wherever you worked in the prison system. And it's still there in different ways now, but and in some ways it should be. But it was very intense at that time of, you know, can we afford to be doing X, Y, and Z? And should we be doing things in this way? And those sorts of questions were really quite, were always there in quite intrusive ways, I guess, at times. And I guess a leadership role is about managing that interface with the wider organisation and to deal with and manage some of those threats. And you probably remember from your Grendon days that, you know, there were quite strong threats around the treatment model and not fitting into the kind of risk needs responsibility sort of framework. So I was, again, really sort of working hard to try and translate the model into that language so that it would, you know, could make a case for it in that alternate parallel language, if you like, because that's not the language of TCs. And so, yes, and I was involved with helping John Shine as well in terms of the work that he was doing at Grendon. And it did feel like we were fighting to survive, really, in terms of at an ideological level as well as a kind of material level in terms of resources and that kind of thing. Though I think some really good things came out of that in terms of new ways of thinking. So, you know, for instance, you know, ideas like offence paralleling behaviour, which was an attempt to pin down exactly what it did, a language for pinning down exactly what one of the processes that goes on in therapeutic communities. And that's a model that's kind of being used everywhere now. So there's a bit of the Max Glatt that's permeated the system. I think TCs generally do that. Well, there's other things that I think that we were doing on the Max Glatt that other people are now doing. And we were doing a version of schema therapy, probably not as sophisticated as the model that you're using now, but we were using a sort of version of schema therapy. We were using a version of DBT as well as in a TC sort of setting. And I don't think there are many other place. I think the TC Plus model actually was quite influenced by also that kind of approach. So there's lots of pioneering work going on there, I guess. And a lot of that was driven by this agenda of trying to survive in a different, there's a dialectic going on there between different models, and it was trying to respond to that creatively, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought were the outstanding features that you remember, but in fact you've mentioned many of them to do with plurality, diversity of approach, and the use of different approaches, offence paralleling behaviours, and so on. And of course, the work that you and John Shine, and I think Mark Morris did in fighting, which was quite a ferocious battle, as I remember it, between these different approaches. It was an outstanding piece of work, which has so far stood the test of time, I think.
Well, I mean, things moved forward there, didn't they, in terms of now there's the TT, the community of communities, and the people, the model's being accepted in its own terms. But at that time, it was having to prove itself in somebody else's world. And I think though, going back to your question about the outstanding features of that, the most memorable parts of that, I don't think any of what I've described there would answer that question. I think the things that were outstanding for me in the memories are the people that I worked with there. Some amazing people. Just watching them grow and change and learning from them. In fact, I would say that I've learned more from the people I've worked with than from any sort of model. There were some amazing people who were brilliant at, residents who were brilliant at both going, taking the risk of changing and engaging with the process, but also in terms of working with each other, incredibly creative and adventurous. And there were times when that experience was, I don't know, there's nothing in TCs, sometimes it's just like hellish. but there are other times when just something really magical happens in that group. Some really incredible people. And I guess one of the key things I learned from that was, things that I think other models of therapy at that time weren't talking enough about, was trauma. The importance of dealing with different kinds of trauma. It was the TC actually for me that taught me, and the group, the community meetings and small groups that taught me most about that, I think. I don't think I got that from my CBT training, my group analysis, when I did a 1-year training and the initial bit of the group analysis training. In fact, there were lots of ways in which both of those approaches were, in complicated ways, trying to avoid.
Oh, yeah.
The elephant in the room. but the guys didn't do that. They were really onto it, and that worked really well. I guess I learned to. Hear that and allow it as a way of working. The other thing I suppose that I learned from that was also though a curiosity about people who didn't thrive in TCs, and also what happens, the potential of harm from people being discharged from TCs. Now, what does it do to you to be voted out if part of you is really committed to that? Or even if you're ambivalent. I became very interested in either holding on to people, clinging on to people's legs to keep them in therapy, which is probably also particularly though not always. But also, you know, well, this isn't for everybody. And so questions around harm, but also questions around different ways of working that work with different people with very different needs. I think that was also something I learned a lot about, or questions and issues that became quite important for me there.
Quite an interesting one, that though, isn't it? Because many of the people that we work with in forensic services have such awful histories of rejection and abandonment earlier that they kind of expect it and set up situations where they preempt it and elicit the rejection.
Yes.
So it can be quite difficult, I think, to get the balance right of making sure that getting yourself rejected and ejected from a service isn't so easy that it can just be done, but also not keeping people in somewhere that actually might be quite harmful to them if it's not the right time for them.
Yes. And I don't think we always get that right. And I think as practitioners, we need to, well, it's interesting, you know, with the, you know, medics have the yellow card system. You know, if your medication has side effects, then you write off to the BMJ or whatever, the British Medical Association or whatever. And you tell them, and then, you know, when you're taking your medication, you've got a list of the side effects and stop taking this if this happens. And but we don't do that as psychologists. We've got this kind of grandiose idea that everything we do, well, it's a caricature, I know, but that we're going to help people all the time. But, you know, any powerful intervention has also got the capacity to make things worse. And I think we need to be open and honest about that and think actively about what we can do to stop that.
And you've written a lot about the importance of working with trauma and being trauma informed. And there's this big push at the moment, isn't there, within forensic environment, or at least there was prior to COVID, within forensic environments to make services more trauma informed. Can you say a bit more about why that seems so relevant within forensic settings?
So yes, gosh, there's lots there really. Well, and I described it as the elephant in the room earlier, didn't I? But in some ways, well, so the first answer to that is because it's been so brutally ignored for so long by systems and therapies. And I include myself there, you know, historically, I remember groups or interventions where people were saying, well, no, don't talk about trauma. You know, you can't, that's excuse making. Or whatever. So I guess that's the first thing, is that it's been so harshly ignored historically. I think it's also about, you know, how can we make sense of what people are doing and without an understanding of their background? I worry about the word trauma. It's beginning to sort of get a bit sort of used for everything and though I think what it has been is a kind of portal or a window that we've managed to open up and look at, give us permission to explore and discuss people's pasts and the importance of learning developmental experiences and how people have, and to move away from explanations that are either, because what's the alternative to you learnt this through painful experiences? Well, it's kind of because you're intrinsically bad somehow, or you're damaged, your brain's damaged, and it's kind of, you're fated to be suffering with that. I think, though, there's a kind of myopia that comes with the word trauma, which is that it kind of ignores the social, the structural, societal processes that drive trauma, that are underpin it, you know, poverty, racism, sexism, homophobia, all these kind of processes that create a kind of context where trauma can thrive, and that actually the problems aren't in linked just with individual experiences, but the wider contexts that have created those, the possibility of those happening. And I suppose the other thing is that the kind of exclusive focus on certain kinds of early experiences, I think perhaps we're going to be moving more in the direction of focusing on, you know, the impact of, you know, racism and microaggressions accumulating for people, and how traumatic and damaging that is for people. And hopefully we'll also begin to think a bit more in terms of existential traumas of, you know, mortality. You know, no one talks about mortality. Well, what's that all about?
That's at the moment.
Well, I was going to say that's what COVID's really got me thinking about mortality and how such a huge issue just never gets mentioned.
Yeah.
And so I described that as existential trauma, and you know, the existentialists were onto that, weren't they? And the whole issue of the absurdity and arbitrariness of human existence, and we're just thrown into it and we don't choose it. Whole huge aspects of who we are and what we are aren't chosen, and we're somehow supposed to just accept that and live with it. Well, a lot of that is traumatic, I think, and doesn't get spoken about. So I think there's lots of areas in relation to trauma that need to be explored and worked with more.
Seems like people can be a bit lazy around, psychologists, psychotherapists can be a bit lazy around the whole notion of trauma as well, can't they? It's just like there's this big lump of trauma in someone's history without actually picking apart what it means, that what is it about that person's experience of those events that's led to the manifestation in the current present of whatever symptoms someone's presenting with, rather than, you know, it's almost like you just have to take it for granted that something traumatic has happened and therefore this is the consequence, rather than understanding how, what the nuances of the impact were.
Yes. That for me is a really important point. I mean, it's the, I was going to use the word mechanisms, but that's got connotations of mechanics. So the processes maybe of trauma. I'm full of questions around that. I'm not sure I've got answers. But really questions around what kinds of experience are linked with what kinds of outcome, and how are they linked. And I think there's a real need to develop a much more sophisticated vocabulary and ways of models for thinking about those links. I think there's lots of developments in terms of the stuff that you're doing at Whitemore in terms of working with the body, and the body keeps the score, and sensory motor work is one aspect of that. That is not about words. It's not about it's about what's going on in the body. I think it's also states of consciousness. You know, psychologists, we should be talking about states of consciousness. It should be part of our bread and butter. Altered states of consciousness. There's a kind of language that's developed around dissociation, but I think there's also other kinds of altered states. There's these which are linked with trauma, but there's also manic and hypermanic states. To use a diagnostic framework, but in the psychodynamic literature, there's a strong theme around manic states of states where people are actively seeking pleasure and disinhibited, and but directly linked with trauma of different kinds. So yes, I mean, there's a whole range of ways in which I think trauma is really important, but has also been neglected. And I think it's curious, isn't it, that there's historically there are moments where it's been recognised and then kind of gone back underground. You know, notably, you know, with Freud, his studies on hysteria. I mean, that's he really took trauma seriously then, and then just denied it. And then back in the sort of 70s, people started talking about it much more, 70s and 80s, and then it was all the whole thing about false memory syndrome. It was just kind of swept away again. So it keeps coming back, and as a theme. But and I think so. There's something about not just recognizing it, but keeping it. We have to. It's like democracy. You have to keep. If we keep working to keep it alive.
It's difficult, it seems to me. That's what you're highlighting, the difficulty of it, because what's required from what you're saying in effective work is complexity and nuance, and maintaining a kind of active engagement on that kind of level is really very, very difficult, particularly in a prison where, you know, maybe there isn't that much in terms of support and guidance.
No, that's a really good point. And I think there's some real problems there in terms of thinking through harmful interventions as well, because I think, again, something we don't talk about enough in terms of working with trauma is the way in which diving in and talking about and exploring issues around trauma in a kind of a naive way or unprepared way or can actually be very triggering and lead into some quite dangerous places. So there's, I think there's a real risk that, again, we don't talk about worked with who have been triggered and gone down the wrong route in terms of their reactions to trauma work, and where we perhaps haven't always appreciated the complexity of those cases. But I think it's also, there's always a risk of people, and it's like with surgery, it's probably a bad analogy, but you know, when you go to surgery, someone says to you, you know, there's an X percentage risk that this could actually be end up in a difficult place or, you know, a bad place for you. And we don't do that, I think, enough in therapy work. And so, yes, overly simplistic or ill thought through approaches to some of these problems, I think, are also something that we need to be highlighting. And I think the way to do that is finding places where people can talk about both what's worked really well, but also what's gone wrong. I'm feeling free to say that.
Mm. Can I just check that? Do we distinguish, when we talk about forensic, are we distinguishing between hospital settings and prison settings? And what might the differences be down to?
Okay, so I think there are differences in terms of the basic philosophy of inevitably a prison has a punitive or a retributional component to it. I think that can be problematic. Whereas hospitals have theoretically an approach which is about treatment and creating a context in which people can get better, in inverted commas. Though I suppose there can be problems with both approaches. So I think the problem with prisons is the retribution, the punishment theme, which can actually create, replay whole sort of dramas around punishment for people that go that have been problematic for them. So I think there's things about having worked in prisons, there's things about working in prison that I think are very positive as well. There's something about, I think it's much easier to have a treatment approach that is consistent in a prison because there's a kind of command structure. If you say this is what's going to happen, then everyone on that unit will theoretically be following that model. Okay. Whereas, I know that's probably a naive version of prison, but whereas in hospital, it's a kind of consent. You have to work through a sort of loose consensus of very different ways of seeing, and sometimes that just ends up with people pulling in lots of different directions. Unless you really get to work on some of those team processes. That can really work well. In fact, going back to the idea of lots of ways of seeing, I think hospitals do that. The model hasn't been articulated properly, but the idea of a multidisciplinary team is actually a way of trying to pull radically different ways of looking at the world all into one room. And to talk in a civil way, to try and arrive at a consensus or some kind of joined up way of thinking and working with people, which is, again, I think a real strength of that approach. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it does in a way. I think it's quite complicated. I was just remembering that the last time I worked in a hospital setting, which was in East London, the idea of a model was anathema to some people because they regarded it as a restriction on their capacity to make decisions. And so that led to all kinds of difficulties in the end.
Well, I wonder whether there is a model, but it's a kind of meta model. It's a model of freedom to make decisions or freedom to be different. But actually, yes, that can be paralyzing in some ways if you want to. That's what I was saying about prisons. You can have a consistent model right the way through, whereas what you have to, there is a meta model in health settings, which is this kind of multidisciplinary model.
Maybe some of that's about the concept of transdisciplinary team working, though, you know, where you might have discussions explicitly about the different models and find a way to sit comfortably together and negotiate those differences so that you're all aiming at a shared goal and outcome from the teamwork. But I think it does take quite a lot of very explicit conversations, which sometimes people are reluctant to do, aren't they? And if people yes. can't manage them maturely because they revert into competition between different resources, then that's quite difficult.
Yes. Yes, I think when that works well, it's where people are collaborating and working on the common humanity in the group. And it's like any group, the dynamics can be very different at different times. At other times, you get a kind of competition between perspectives, and or people pairing up, or it's just classic group dynamic stuff, isn't it? people sort of going off into cliques, and all of that gets made worse, I feel, by sort of issues around cost improvements, and that just makes it really difficult.
Yeah, it heightens competition, doesn't it, and rivalry?
It can do. Well, depending on people and relationships, it can heighten competition, conscious or unconscious, and people are always thinking, well, they've got to protect their jobs, but also maybe show that they can do everyone else's job. it all gets complicated. But there are also, I've had experiences of working with different professions where, you know, you manage to get through that and work sensibly together.
One of the things you discuss in your book chapter on trauma-informed care and confinement is the idea that sometimes in institutions, residents might develop generalised reactions to staff that remind them of perpetrators of abuse. What impact do you think this has on the residents and on the staff?
So I guess that's, again, that's complicated because I think there's... it's not just the residents who've got issues around trauma. I guess the staff also have those issues and they bring those with them. But the danger is that people begin to treat staff as if they are abusers or perpetrators of abuse or about and see them through that lens, if you like. And I think a really powerful survival strategy will have been for a lot of people that because you can't trust people in authority, you have to link in really strongly, really often, with your peer group in order to survive and form these kind of enclaves or pockets of resistance or some of which is healthy, some of which can actually be quite unhealthy. There are kind of urges and social processes which are about revenge or some kind of getting your own back on authority for what authority has done to you. I guess when we were talking about trauma earlier, I think for me the one of the key issues is that we're not just talking for most people about one incident of trauma. Obviously, we're talking about a whole litany of events that go right the way back. Mostly offences that have been committed against people, let's put it in those terms, that haven't been convicted. So people are who commit serious offences have been victims of violent abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, a whole range of adverse experiences, some of which would have hit kind of legal thresholds, some of which have been just below, but will accumulate, rejection, abandonment, all of that. So it's a litany of injustice in people's pasts, and so it's that kind of need to establish justice for people, the feeling of injustice that people will have about their lives that they want to restore, put right, that kind of creates this need for revenge or getting your own back or subverting or undermining authority. And I think that that does really get in the way sometimes, though you can see how, you know, some versions of that solidarity can actually be really quite healthy for people. So there becomes a kind of revenge tennis that goes on. You know, somebody takes it out on staff, and then staff take it out on residents, and they get caught up in that kind of to-ing and fro-ing. And there has to be some way of breaking out of those cycles, I think. I'm quite interested in the idea of restorative justice, of different versions of restorative justice. Estelle Moore at Brougham has been getting me to think about some of that, but wouldn't it be good if we could find some way of letting people know that we acknowledge the injustices in their past, the litany of injustices, not just one, there's a kind of cascading series of horrific injustices in people's pasts. We need to name that and actually say sorry for it, and actually do something, say is in some way trying to make it up to people for that, as a way of also allowing them and freeing them up to do the same. But typically what you have in terms of trauma histories is just this huge sense of injustice that has then created the context in which people give themselves permission to do all sorts of nasty things. So moving away from a kind of revenge tennis model to a kind of ways in which people can make it up to each other and say sorry and repair and restore things, I think is really important.
That's so true. And I think, you know, what you end up with, I think, when people have got this long history of being wronged by authority figures, is that you end up with this, as you call it, revenge tennis, which is very complex, and then it makes it very difficult to unpick allegations of abuse and get the balance right between safeguarding the residents and also safeguarding staff. I went to one hospital where if a resident made an allegation against a staff member, they were not allowed to come to work whilst the allegation was investigated. And of course, the resident, there'd become this culture whereby residents were deliberately doing that to get rid of staff that they disliked. And of course, staff were very frightened to challenge patients at times appropriately, because they were fearful that if they did do and were seen as being firm, that they would find themselves on the receiving end of some kind of malicious allegation. So actually, restorative justice seems to offer a way forward that would enable some of those hurts to be put to bed rather than have to live on in the present, so that you would hope then that when allegations are made, they're more likely to only be made because that actually somebody has been wronged and it needs to be resolved.
Yes, I think it's part of a potential solution. I must admit that we've not achieved that at Rampton. it's aspirational, really. Though I've heard about some really interesting and work in people like Estelle Moore and Gerard Drennan doing that. And we're certainly thinking about ways in which we can try and do more of that kind of thing at Rampton. I think that question, though, isn't an easy one to answer, because I think it gets more complicated in that staff get pulled into inappropriate behaviour, and residents get pulled into inappropriate behaviour. So it's really difficult to work out what's true and what's fiction, or not fiction, but not quite so true. And unpicking that can be horrendously complicated sometimes. And, you know, both parts of that relationship are bringing in things from their pasts. And I guess what I would say is that we need to be thinking about both groups, staff and residents, in that similar kind of ways. I think there's a real sort of, there's a tendency to see, to try and recognise trauma and history of the people, the residents, but then describe staff as punitive or describe them as defending themselves against anxiety. But actually, if we look past that, it's actually the same thing we need to be doing with staff, which is, you know, what happened to you to bring you to this place, to want to set boundaries in this way. And when that happens, I think then you begin, you know, so if people are behaving in a way that appears punitive, then it's actually finding out the why question, why. And when you look through that, it's usually often, not always, but linked with their experiences of trauma. You know, the horrible incident that happened on their ward where they, because they didn't set boundaries, or they saw somebody getting hurt and they thought, well, this is because, you know, people are getting away with murder in here and I've got to, it's me that has to do something about that because no one else, you know, it's looking at what's underneath that approach and trying to move away from our, and I guess we all do that, both with residents and staff and probably ourselves as well, using caricatures and easy ways of describing things of, you know, just punitive or just nasty. And there's a, you know, you can get caught up, I do it myself sometimes, you're caught up in a language which is about, pointing your finger at particular groups of people in a way that can be unhelpful. Blame cultures, I think, part of that as well. So it's breaking away from all of that.
Okay. Can I return to my interest in the Max Glatch Centre? Why did it close? It'd been running for some 25 years or so.
Yes. So I think the simple answer to that is I don't know. There are more complicated answers. I think, TCs are sort of famous for closing, aren't they? The first thing I would say there is, I think I mentioned it earlier, is that it was always under threat. And particularly, I think TCs that are set within other, in a larger organisation, have that, because they're implicitly a critique of the wider organisation. They're implicitly saying, well, actually, you know, you could be, hey, you guys, you could be doing things very differently. and that's actually quite challenging. But it's all, in some ways, it's hard enough to do that with the whole organisation. The whole prison's a TC. It's still difficult to do that. But when you're a small unit in a larger prison, then that. And I think one of the things that the Max Glatt did was, I think staff on there particularly were raising issues around inappropriate behaviour of staff outside of the unit, which was quite challenging and was important to be raised and was being addressed by senior management, but actually in some ways set it up as different from and perhaps a threat in some ways. I think that's a difficult issue. But I think there's also just really basic things in terms of finding people who were willing and able to think and work in that way. I'm not sure that they were always possible. I think the other thing was Max Glatt himself, who's an amazing guy, he was in his, I don't know, 70s or something, used to dodder in, sit on groups every week, and he stopped coming in, and I think that was also something that his going, I think, was or or his lack of ability to engage as much as he had, I think, was a problem. I think he'd been quite useful in terms of keeping it open historically, because he was well known and well connected. I was trying to think of other things that were wanted to close. Well, as I said earlier, I think there was it was a time at which programs that didn't fit neatly into the accredited models then were either having to stop or develop accreditation. And I think there were some real concerns about the model and the extent to which it was being delivered as a TC, some real questions around some of those issues, I think, were foregrounded, really.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think the TC at Gartree was under pressure at the same time for rather similar reasons.
Yes.
Looking at your chapter in the Therapeutic Community for Offenders book, which was the book that I read prior to me starting at Grendon, actually, so it was a very influential book. And but in your chapter, you write very interesting chapter, actually, which brings together, I think, a lot of the things that you've described this afternoon. But you write a lot about treatment interfering behaviours. And I was wondering whether your approach to such behaviours has changed much in the intervening 20 odd years.
Let me think. Well, yes, I think it has. I suppose the, a lot of my thinking was formed from that experience. In that chapter, I'm talking a lot about how to identify people who might drop out and trying to find out ways of holding on to them or not taking them on in the first place, because I think there's something about not harming people if you think there's a high risk that they're going to drop out or that kind of thing. I suppose where my thinking has changed since then is more about that we have to be adapting our therapies much more to fit the people that we work with. So it's not, are you suitable for a TC, but you know, what can we be doing differently to cater for your needs? I guess that's change. I suppose the other idea is, for me, is that in terms of engagement, I think I will probably, at the time of writing that chapter, I had a much more kind of cognitivist approach to things, which is that, you know, people have conscious beliefs that they act on and respond to, and I was interested in a version of the idea of the unconscious then as well. But I think for me, one of the key things that we need to be working with is the idea that, well, I mentioned it earlier, the idea that people have multiple states, and a lot of the time when people do things that are hard to understand, they're in altered states, not just in terms of emotion, but also in terms of their capacity to think, willingness to think. So you might be able to think, but just not hate the idea of thinking. Attacks on linking, is that stuff from beyond? But I think there's the ways of thinking about that as well. So altered states of consciousness that actually, and also that this idea of people just having one way of being in the world. I think people are actually more like a community of different parts of different selves. And so working with all of those different versions that people have of themselves. And in some ways, I think it's working, for instance, you know, nursing staff who work with someone whilst they're in a state of just after they've self-harmed or just before they've self-harmed, you know, in a state of dissociation or withdrawal. It's meeting that person and working with that person in that state, I think that's important. and that we kind of haven't really, it's parts of the self that you can't, it's very difficult to bring into the therapy room. And I guess it's also working, as I was saying earlier, with the body as well, what's going on in the body, and states linked with that. And I guess one of the key bits of that is that these are often experiences that don't live easily in language, and we need to find ways of languaging them. But these are states and ways of being that people don't know how to talk about. They live with them in a sort of a private space, a locked off, shut off space, or even spaces that they enter temporarily and then exit very quickly without wanting ever to admit to themselves that they're in those states. That's, I think what's would be different with the way I think about things now. Since writing that chapter, I've done two other publications looking at managing and working with engagement. And one of the key aspects of that was also doing formulation. So just the question, asking the question, why is this person not engaging? What is my formulation for that? Another interesting angle, I think, is that I found useful anyway, is Lorna Benjamin's work, where she talks about people's forming, having a kind of perverse loyalty to parents. So it's kind of two processes. One is I'm acting exactly like you did, mom or dad, love me for it. Or I'm acting the opposite of you, love me in spite of it. And there's something about behaving in a particular way, which is about a kind of loyalty or an act of commitment, or it's a kind of perverse loyalty. So being asked to change is about giving up on that relationship, giving up on those commitments. So what you lose by changing is sense that either your parents, or I think it's also true for social groups, your social group will no longer accept you or love you or care for you because you're not that person anymore.
Okay, in that same book chapter, which you probably haven't thought about for 20 years or more, you give some examples of institutional dynamics affecting treatment, and they both sounded very familiar to me in their slightly different ways. So you mentioned, obviously changed name, John had requested an extended visit with his mother, which the prison had somewhat reluctantly agreed to. But then on the day, the visit was sabotaged and it was curtailed. Yeah. And we know, we all know, and Naomi and I have had conversations with people that such seemingly minor incidents can have a significant effect on somebody's relationship with authority. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on how these dynamics can be managed. Do you see any improvement in institutions over these years?
Gosh, I'm not sure. Well, I guess I've seen change. I think probably organisations are much more risk averse. The idea of people going out on visits and that sort of thing happens much less now. I remember when I was on the Max Lab, we used to have people going on home leave. It was always a discussion point in the community meetings, and people would actually go off, and then they would come back and tell us about it. Whereas now, I think there's much more kind of reluctance to do that. I think the obvious thing is to try and work on organisational trauma awareness, and help get commitment from the organisation to be aware of the way in which these decisions can impact on people, and awareness of what the impact of decision-making can be on someone's progress in therapy. I think those are the sort of the kinds of intervention, but I don't get a strong sense in which that's something that would be easy in prisons or indeed in, to some extent in hospital. We're really pushing at the moment down a more trauma-informed way of working, but as often is the case in these things, I think it often depends on individuals. You know, if you get senior managers who understand, then you get a cascading through the organisation of this, of it working, or a more, it doesn't always work, but a more aware culture. But then if there's a kind of reluctance at a senior management level, then that can be a problem.
So interesting, Lawrence, when you think about the kind of like the number of significant incidents or events that happen in prisons and hospitals, and that quite clearly leave a scar in the culture, and it ends up calcifying as particular places becoming known for being either very security focused or very rigid and punitive. Attention is given to the healing of the culture of the organisation when there's some kind of injury to it.
Yes. So yes, I mean, I think that's what I was talking about earlier in terms of asking why, what happened, what got you here, and what can we do to help with that that trauma, that you know, the serious incidents that people have experienced or witnessed, and then trying to help people to process their anxieties about that. Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. But I suppose, but I think there's also a danger of getting caught up in a kind of narrative around that, which is, because I think there's also something about celebrating times when that hasn't happened, looking at the exceptions and really sort of developing a way of talking that recognises that and recognises the humanity of people. An example for that for me was a guy I worked with, a prison officer who seemed to me to be very punitive, and I took him to one side when he first started working with Max Glatland, and I gave him a little talking to, and but he didn't change, and he was talking about, you know, his violent urges to be violent and all sorts of things publicly in front of residents. And but he was really interesting because he never did it. He would talk about it, but he never did it. His colleagues wouldn't talk about it, but they were doing it. And this was on the Mac Flapper. And so towards it, and the guys really liked him. So towards the end of my stay there, and his stay there, I mean, he really got drawn into the TC and loved it. And but he didn't change that much. He was still talking about his. So when he said these things, I would say, thanks for sharing that fantasy. So there's something about recognizing that and understanding that you know, it's important for people to talk about their dark sides and not to act on, and having spaces where people are able to admit to that.
But you're also right about the need for celebrations, and I think forensic services are not good at that. We're not good at savoring the successes or the joy in there. There's too much attention at times. It feels like all the attention goes on worrying about what might happen, and I think partly David and I wanting to do this podcast because we wanted to celebrate some of the positivity that can be around, whether that be about individual staff members who are really passionate and compassionate in their approach to work, or new innovations at things that enrich the environment. But certainly, you know, part of our motivation was about trying to give some attention to some of the positives.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, someone who really got me thinking about that was Neil Gordon. Do you know Neil Gordon?
Yeah. Positive person himself.
When he was at the at Rampton, I was wittering on about how working with people who offended sexually, you know, really gets to staff and how the harm that it does to them. In fact, what I did was I'd done a little study where I looked at a whole list of things in the literature that were bad things that happened to staff doing sex offender groups. And I just pointed out that it had the same effect on a lot of the residents. If it does that to staff, what's it doing to the residents? But Neil came back to me and he sent me this paper. I think it was called something like working with sex offenders with the guts to change. And it was all about how positive that is for you as a practitioner to work with people who are full of courage and have taken some huge risks, and what that actually does for you as a practitioner. In fact, it's quite addictive, isn't it? I mean, that kind of affirmation been, it's a real privilege to actually to be there as part of that process with people. And I don't think we talk about that enough. There's this kind of narrative, well, you know, doesn't it make us all sort of traumatized and whatever? Yes, it can do, but also can give you an incredible perspective on what's possible for human beings to achieve when they're trying to do something to sort things out in their lives. How miraculous that is, really.
Absolutely. I think often you get asked, you know, isn't it frightening working in a prison? And it's like, yes, it can be frightening, but equally, I have moments of such pride, admiration, joy at seeing people's kind of like growth, sat there and felt the feelings of love that people have for one another in a room. So all of the whole breadth of human experience, I think, is experienced within these environments, and it's not just the dark side of human nature that we end up exploring, but also these really touching, poignant moments as well, which are so powerful.
So yes, I think there's two sides of that. I think there's the version of that which is really healthy. I think there's also an unhealthy version of that, which is, you know, to what extent are we doing what we do because of what we get from it? And whilst there's nothing wrong with getting something from it, in fact, we have to get something from it, and it is important. I think there's a danger of that blinding us to when we're actually harming people, or we could be making things worse. So there's we always have, whilst we need to be celebrating and enjoying what we do, we need also to be asking ourselves difficult questions about, you know, am I doing this for me, or am I doing it for you, or with you, I suppose. Yes, I mentioned the word addiction earlier, and I remember when I arrived at Rampton after working at the Max Glad, and I was getting something like withdrawal symptoms from not being on group. When I was at the Max Glad, I was on groups nearly all day, every day, and I arrived at Rampton, and yes, I was doing some group work, but it wasn't the same, and I remember just getting real cravings and missing feelings, and I was wondering, you know, how much of that had been, and some of that was about missing that, exactly what you've just been talking about, in a healthy sense. But it was also that in some ways I'd become dependent on that. In what ways is it sustaining me as a person? And again, it's good that therapy sustains the therapist, but that's not what it's for. And I know from looking at myself and colleagues that, you know, sometimes that can get in the way of us recognising when we're doing things that aren't always as helpful as they might be.
No, it sounds as if, because I was going to ask you, how do you keep hope alive within these settings and in this work? It sounds as if you partly answered that by highlighting the importance of being reflective about what we're doing, what we enjoy, how we may be doing harm. And that's a kind of central part of how we ought to be looking after ourselves. But maybe you've got something to add to that.
Well, yeah, what else? Well, I was thinking about that. I think there's the first thing I would say is we need to allow hopelessness. Yes, to being with other people and allowing yourself to think and feel. It's not just, quite often people talk about, you know, hope as being about keeping the capacity to think alive. But it's also, it's both, it's keeping capacity to think, but also the capacity to feel. And again, I think in forensic settings, there's a real danger of kind of different types of numbness, insensitivity to pain that can happen because you've exposed to so many narratives of pain. So it's keeping your ability to hurt alive. Sounds paradoxical, but I think that's actually important.
And we're coming to the end of the interview, Lawrence, but one of the questions that we've asked everybody is whether you could recommend something that you find uplifting that keeps you going during difficult times, whether that be something that you've watched or read, something that you find inspiring?
Yes, I've heard, I listened to some of the previous ones, and I've heard about David and your opera, which is sounds really, really good. And I was trying to think of what my equivalent to that would be. And I suppose it is music. I will sometimes pick up a guitar and play music. Or listening to music. I like Bach's cello music. That really does it for me. But also things like walking and I guess reading. those are the things I think that, and obviously being with people who are important to me.
That's brilliant, thank you. I mean, you've been so generous with your time today, and it would be quite easy to sit and chat to you for hours, actually, Lawrence. You're so thought-provoking and so well-read and drawing on knowledge from so many places. So I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, me too. Very, very thoughtful afternoon.
Well, thank you for asking those questions. It's really got me thinking and feeling stuff as well.
Thank you.
So it was a real pleasure meeting with Lawrence. I've crossed paths with Lawrence on numerous occasions over the past 20 years, but having that conversation with him, I realised that his experience is even longer and deeper than I thought. It's really interesting hearing him talk about his time at Wormwood Scrubs and the kind of developments that took place there, because you realise that somebody gets associated with a place. So, for example, Dr. Max Glatch, who clearly was a very, very well-intentioned and creative leader of a project, but he wasn't the only one. So Lawrence was there, of course, and he mentioned several colleagues who made considerable contributions to the development of the program that came to be called the Annex at the Max Glatt unit. So it was really interesting hearing they're important reminiscences of a time when something existed. And don't forget, the Max Glatt unit existed for about 30 years and then it came to an end. And we weren't able to really fathom why it had come to an end, but we suspect it was something to do with money and the opening of Dovegate and things like that. Anyway, they were my first impressions.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that conversation. Found it really interesting to dwell on some of the themes. I think it was good to hear about Lawrence's own background in terms of why he's so interested in being more inclusive, and that's clearly been there as a feature of his work throughout his career. I think you're right about that, the notion that something existed for 30 years and was apparently doing a great job and then can somehow end up folding is quite sad, really, when you think about the kind of like passion that must have gone into developing that service and to have it running. But I suppose the other things that I took from there were Lawrence's points about needing to develop a much better, a much richer language about trauma. And I think too easily people get quite lazy as practitioners and talking about someone having a history of trauma. But of course, the vast majority of people who have a traumatic history don't end up in contact with the criminal justice system. And I think there's something about really digging into the experience of trauma to have a better understanding of what it is about those experiences that might lead some people to end up in contact with the justice system. And then also his talking about, which is right, highlighting that we don't think enough about altered states of consciousness, and we don't really have enough language to even talk about that very easily, do we? So a lot of food for thought in that interview, I think.
Yeah, I think you're quite right, and you're highlighting really the developments in his thinking, particularly over the time since he left Wormwood Scrubs, with his focus upon
trauma and the detail of trauma.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.